Hey, we've got a treat tonight. We're going to be talking to Tina Rice and Angie Elfin, and they are both very Howard County. It seems like a lot of the people I interview anymore are immigrants coming in. But Angie, what's your connection to Howard County over your lifetime?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. So my mother is a John Meyer, and my father is a Stroatman. And so that makes me related to a lot of Howard Countyans. And so I'm a therapist here, and all my kids and grandkids all live in Howard County. And so the tradition continues.
There you go.
Yeah.
And you are very Howard County too, Tina.
Born and raised. Yes, I am. My father was Tommy Williams, and my mother was Beverly Beach. She's actually migrated from Iowa. She was a Quaker when she came to Missouri, but she settled in Armstrong, and they met, and the rest is history. I have brothers here, lots of extended family, and have lived here most of my life. So,
have you ever lived out of Howard County?
I've lived in Moberly for about 10 years
okay.
in Randolph County, and then came back.
Yeah,
it drew me back.
And briefly, what is your day job?
So I've been in social work, and I taught for 10 years, but I've been in social work the rest of my adult life. Right now, I'm the executive director of the Howard County Shelter and Services Board, and we serve people in Howard County with intellectual disabilities. And I've been doing that for almost 8 years now. So, yeah.
Well, I want to concentrate tonight on asking you all about the trip you made a little less than a year ago to Nepal. And when I heard you were going to Nepal in February, I thought, what were these two thinking?
Well, and I have to say that's a long way away. You find out when, you know, it was probably a 30-hour trip, and about 26 of that's airtime. So it's a long way away.
Yeah. So there were several times that we wondered the same thing. What are we doing? And why are we going so far away?
In February.
In February.
Well, I hear that Mount Everest is not as crowded that time of year.
I'm sure.
We didn't quite make it that far up, so we don't know that one for sure.
Yeah, we made it up to about 8,000 feet, and it was cold there. And, and Mount Everest was about two ranges away from us where we were at one point in time, and it's cold at 8,000 feet, so I can't even imagine, you know, further than that. So
No, the snow would be flying around big time. It's amazing. You said 30 hours. What, where did you get on and get off and end up and all of that? How describe this?
So we
flight.
Went from Kansas City to where did we stop? I'd have to think for a second.
Was it Detroit? Maybe that was no.
We had a different cut, a little bit of a different loop going as coming, but we met up with part of the group. Our group ended up being people from Missouri, Tennessee, Arizona. Perhaps that was the bulk, Kentucky and Haiti.
And Haiti.
And we ended up meeting in Kathmandu. But so everybody kind of came from different directions. For us, it was Kansas City to, I think you're right, Detroit at one time. We had a layover, though, coming and going in Seoul, South Korea. And then from there, hopped over to Kathmandu. And all of Nepal is a mountain. I mean, there's even Kathmandu, which is probably the flattest portion, is in low mountain ranges. So I don't know if you've ever heard before, but Nepal has the most dangerous airports to try to land in.
Oh, I was going to ask about that.
And the worst ones are the ones closer to you know, in further into the mountains, but even for us. So that was on our mind as we were getting ready to land, for sure.
Now, I've kind of got the impression that the southern half of Nepal can be kind of tropical, or is that just in the summer?
Perhaps in the summer, but it butts up against, and I didn't have my map with me right now, but it's pretty much mountain range, and India is south of that, and of course we know it's warmer there, but it is definitely flat there as well. Right behind Nepal, again, in the mountain ranges, at the top of that, the mountain ranges, the other side is Tibet. And it's a very small country, and the other side of that is China. So very close to China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The weather was much like we're having right now.
Okay.
So much like...
In Kathmandu.
In Kathmandu.
Yeah.
So 60s to 70s, probably mid-70s during the day, down to the 40s at night.
Okay.
And that was pretty consistent the whole time we were in Kathmandu.
Mm-hmm. And we were there in February mm-hmm. to March.
Yeah, that's not bad then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine has traveled everywhere from Glasgow, and he said, mm-hmm. well, Nepal, the southern half is pretty pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it is.
Now, the difference is that we didn't have heat. So a lot of the homes do not have heat in them. And I'm not sure that we ever really determined why that was. But a lot of the houses are those block houses that kind of hold the cold in.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went up to the farm, there was no heat even to cook with. So we cooked with wood stove the entire time we were there. Mm-hmm. So I think the temperature kind of plays off of how they live, which is fairly...
frugally.
Yes.
Yeah. Why were you there? What were you trying to accomplish?
All right. Well, this is kind of where we back up and mm-hmm. talk about a little bit. When
sure.
we were talking about our time in Howard County, we haven't mentioned that we were born in the hospital together, in Keller mm-hmm. Memorial Hospital.
Oh, my.
And we've known each other and been really great friends our entire life. So we've had other work experiences abroad together. And so the reason we were kind of drawn into this one is we had done a lecture mm-hmm. At a church in Kentucky that sponsors an organization called Hope Force International. And Hope Force International is a sister organization to the Salvation Army. The gentleman who started Hope Force International is actually the same person who used to be in charge of running Mercy Ships. I don't know if that's something, Sam, you've heard of before.
Yep.
They're not out in the ocean anymore, but they kind of moved that inland. And one of the things they were focusing on was a supporting crisis domestically, and they focused on the U.S. for a long time. And that would have been natural crisis, like tornadoes and hurricanes and natural disasters. And
tsunamis,
they, yes,
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they taught part of, you know, their classes that they teach are how to help people in crisis, whether it's emotionally, spiritually, physically, if there's things they need assistance with, to help with, you know, those immediate needs of food and shelter right after a crisis. And they actually have people that are on standby deployment for their organization. And they actually, the reason they started working in Nepal and Haiti as well was through natural disaster. Nepal had an earthquake, 2019 perhaps.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
That.
So they went over there to assist with that. And what
okay.
they found was a lot more. They just found a lot more need.
Mm-hmm.
So Angie, you want to mm-hmm. comment on kind of our... are getting into this with Hope Force?
Yeah, so sometime in 2016, Tina and I were doing a little research, looking at what trips were available. Like she had mentioned, we had done several trips before this. So we'd spent some time with Hurricane Katrina. We went down to New Orleans and worked in January after Hurricane Katrina. We'd spent some time in Costa Rica. Tina actually did two trips to Costa Rica, and I had done one trip, a work trip. And so we started thinking about what is our next adventure? What is it that we want to do? So in 2016, we found this opportunity to go to some training that Hope Force International was offering in...
Murfreesboro.
Thank you.
That's a tough
Murfreesboro, Tennessee. We spent all week there, and we learned how to say the name a little bit. But we went to some training to learn what Hope Force International was about, if this was something that we felt like we wanted to be a part of. We were able to go through that training and then come back. And they actually deploy people out on a regular basis, but they also have trips that you can plan. So because of Tina and I's job, it's hard to just jump and leave on a 24-hour notice. I think someday it might be something that we both entertain, but right now it's not feasible to do with our jobs. So we started looking into what they were doing in other places. There was an opportunity to go to Kentucky to work with folks in the McDowell County, I believe, which is the has the highest poverty rate in any county in the United States. So we looked at West Virginia, sorry. Yes, West Virginia. So we looked at what it would take to get a team together, and we started working on that. But that was, we were starting to work on it right as COVID was starting to kind of flare up and happen. And so it was kind of iffy as to whether or not everyone was going to be able to go, what people's fears were about going. And so it kind of started taking a back burner. And one day we were looking through, or we got an alert that said they were needing people to go to Nepal. And we thought about it, and we thought, well, let's apply. Let's try to see if they need us. So the other thing we look for is, what are the jobs that they need, and can we fulfill that? So when we went to Hurricane Katrina, that job was very physical, probably the hardest physical job I've ever done in my life. I knew I couldn't do a job like that anywhere anymore.
That was a decade ago.
That was
a lot younger.
Yeah. And that was hard. And so they had a construction crew and they had a medical team that they were starting to gather people up to send to Nepal. Well, Tina and I don't, either of us don't have any medical, but we do have some construction experience. And we both have been raised on farms. We're pretty, you know, we can figure things out pretty well. So we applied, and I think
it was also a social work component to it, too.
Yes.
And that kind of leads into why they had begun to work in Nepal.
So we applied, and we told them what we do for a living, what our education is, that kind of thing. And it took them probably about 6 months to let us know that we had been accepted into this trip. And when I say accepted, a lot of people think, oh, well, they pay for your stuff. And it's not that at all. It's a very expensive trip to make. But we have made a commitment that we don't want this expense to be on others. We're here to help and learn from others. So we don't want to take away from anything else. So we would have to, and we did, pay for our own trip. Now, I think in the past, we have done some fundraising, but this one we did completely on our own, and that was kind of the next steps.
The main expense probably was the flight.
Yes.
Actually,
yeah.
It was.
Yes.
And, yeah. And when it comes to travel, it really wasn't too expensive besides the flight. It's about $1,900 to fly round trip. The rest of it, when you get there, and it's been the same with all volunteer experiences, they will put you up and they will provide food for a very, minimal amount.
Right.
But typically there's an expectation too, for whatever your group is going to work on while you're there, the materials needed for that, your group will pay for. And again, that's part of the giving process, not just the time, but also the resources as well. So, but when you think about $500 and what that buys here, $500 is just an enormous amount of money in Nepal. So it goes a long way.
Yeah.
You could do a lot of projects for $5,000 a person, $500 a person. So that's about was the total cost between those two things. But when we got there, we had a nice kind of communal house to stay in Kathmandu. And that's when we really started to understand what those projects were going to be. We ended up, that team of collective people coming from different places around the United States, when we ended up getting there, there was probably a total of maybe 15, 20 people. And we met Silvio. Silvio is the one who's kind of in charge of the projects that they have there. And Silvio is a... he's from Brazil. He's a missionary from Brazil. He's been in Nepal about 20 years. And when he arrived there, one of the things that he found that's really, really tragic is not just the poverty, but what happens as a result of poverty. And one of the things is there is no medical care. Also that resources are very limited. And the high amount of human trafficking that is coming out of Nepal due to just extreme, again, extreme poverty. And so he started to work on those things while he was there. And so when that hurricane, or that earthquake, I'm sorry, happened in, I believe, 2019, and Hope Force International arrived to assist with that, it had done some damage to some of the things that Silvio had started. He had started a community school, residential homes for children that had been recovered and rescued from trafficking. And then he also had a place in the mountains called The Farm, and that supplies the resources for the homes and the schools. So with farm animals and farming. And so the earthquake had damaged both of those. Wow. So when Hope Force came to assist with that, they really found a dedicated Christian missionary in a Hindu country. And so Christianity is definitely in the minority. But the amazing things that he had done while he was there. So they found other levels that they wanted to continue to support. Hope Force is a Christian-based organization of compassion and rescue and crisis. So, you know, over the last 5 years, probably that team then has, other than COVID, they've been there a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So the people that we joined had been there at least once, most of them.
Mm-hmm. All but one. There were three brand new, Tina and I and one other gentleman that were brand new to this team. The rest of the team had been together not only in Nepal, but in other areas helping as well. So they kind of knew each other, had some knowledge of what each of them could do, and really supported what Silvio had started. And he lived there with his wife, and his children had been raised there. So he had actually started, I think they said he had been there 9 years. So it has taken quite a while for mm-hmm. him to build up this presence in Nepal and kind of what this mission was about. And it was a lot about Christianity and bringing that to the people to help them understand and have some hope for something different. He and his wife had built a school right in Kathmandu, and it was a very small school to start. Surrounding the school were several homes, which Tina had mentioned, where they house children being brought out of trafficking. And so they would place these children in these homes. And as the children grew in these homes, they would either be placed back with their parents if everything had been...
if it was safe.
If it was safe for them to go back. But if it was not safe, they would grow up in these homes and actually had the opportunity. They called it fly away mm-hmm. home. They could fly away and become their own person, mm-hmm. or they could stay in the homes and actually help with this program. So every person that we met, if they were not a missionary, they were from the homes that they had grown up there. And mm-hmm. Silvio still oversees all of this operation with, and you can tell him about the company that we joined with.
So Hope Force International, or Silvio, his Christian mission is called Apple of God's Eye. And in Nepal, because it is a Hindu country, and they, if something is occurring that is Christian and good, you know, it's difficult for the country. The government's not appreciative of that. So it had another name, as long as it was called Nepalese Children's Home, right. Then it was okay. The children that were rescued, there were 8 houses, mm-hmm. probably I would say up to 50 per house. So you can kind of get an idea how many children we're talking about. And then the school probably had about 450 children mm-hmm. that attended that at this point. And so what they found, he found is as he was able to rescue children, then when they were back in their homes, which weren't necessarily safe, it just depended. Sometimes those children were trafficked for several reasons. They might have been trafficked because the family could not afford to keep them, and they ended up on the street, and natural occurring trafficking occurred. Sometimes they thought they were sending their children off to do work with a family or somewhere else, and then they just never heard from that child again. And in reality, that's not what was happening. That child was being trafficked. Sadly, but they mentioned it to us several times, there's also an industry for the medical community globally for bones and tissue and human remains. And so sometimes those children were used for that as well, unfortunately. So the main traffic area was to India, but then expands beyond that. But as those children were being rescued, sometimes then when they would come back and people would know that's what happened to them, they were being bullied at school, they were being teased at school, they weren't being integrated, they were already traumatized. So that wasn't a good thing. Sometimes at home there was resentment that they didn't go off and do what the family thought that they were going to go off and do, and somehow that was their child's fault. Or sometimes family might have had to traffic a child out of desperation, and so bringing them back is embarrassing. So for a lot of, you know, unfortunate reasons, it's not always good just to go straight back home or straight to school. And so he ended up creating this safe place for them to be. And it's interesting because now we have 450 children that when they're at school, they receive, they of course know Nepalese, but they're also taught English and they speak English very well. So now they're bilingual. They're taught skills. They have a sewing area. They have a bridal shop. They have a salon. What else was it that they have there for them to teach and learn? But anyway, so what's happened now is the community around them of Nepalese children going to Nepalese school, they all want to go there.
Hmm.
And because those kids come out with a great education, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily the public education in Nepal. And so, again, a lot of them, the reason the bridal shop is so important is because they also try to teach about positive, healthy relationships. And marriage is a good thing. And raising a family is a good thing. Don't think about this tragedy that has happened to you as what it, you know, don't carry that burden through your life. Have positive relationships in your life. So actually, I mean, marriage is a big thing mm-hmm. when they find someone they want to marry. And so we assisted at the school to help the medical team check, kind of have a little clinic in the school to check the kids. They don't normally get any medical care. There's not really a formal medical care insurance program in Nepal. And so that's the only way some of them get medical care. You want to talk about some other things that we did?
It's cool. Yeah, so there was also a construction event going on at the school where they were building a library for the children. And so we were able to help with the library as well. The hard part about the library was that it was on top of the school building. So it was carrying concrete walls up these flights of stairs up into the top. Where they were putting the library. So the children would also have to go up to the top of the building, which was outside for the most part, just a little court area out on top of the building. We also did some just sitting with the kids. So the kids were really wanting to talk to us, wanting to tell us different things that they were doing at school. And they were really curious to meet us, to talk to us, which was really interesting as well. We were at the school for 3 days, I believe, in Kathmandu before we also deployed up to the farm, which Tina had mentioned that they have a farm as well.
Do you want to talk about the homes?
Mm-hmm. So we spent 1 day visiting the homes. So we went to, I believe, 3 different homes. They're right in the same neighborhood. We walked to the homes where the children greeted us at the door, invited us in, had us sit down. So culture says we take our shoes off outside of the door. They bring us in, we sit down, and they serve us. So we had Coca-Cola at every place that we stopped that day and some type of cookie or cracker, something to feed us as well. Then they would give us a tour of their homes, including their bedrooms. And they were so proud of their bed. And everything was in tip-top shape. Every shoe was put up. Everything was in very good order. And the older children help the younger children do all of that. So one bedroom might have 8 to 10 children in it. So there were bunk beds everywhere. But that child's belongings were on their bunk or in a little cabinet beside their bunk bed. And so they would show us their stuffed animals. They would were really excited to show us things that they had. And when you think about the level of poverty that they were coming from, these things would have meant a lot to these children. They did not have this where they came from. Or if they had, they were being taken away from it. And so then they had nothing for a while. The system works much as our children's division system works here. So the government would go in and remove the children from the home or remove them from where they were being trafficked or whatever the situation was. They would place them into one of these homes for just a little while to make sure that they physically were okay, mentally okay, to be then put into one of the homes that housed all of the children. There was a counseling center. They had just really opened it. In fact, they were moving it from one building to another. And they were teaching people who had been through the program how to become therapists to help these children understand the trauma that they had been through and coping skills to get to the next level. So the kids were kind of taken through that and then placed into these homes and then would start school at the school that we visited. And all of the children would know that that was a safe place. As we visited each of the houses, there were signs hanging on the houses that were as big as the first floor. So we're talking a sign that goes from bottom to the top floor that said in English and in Nepalese how to treat the children when we walk in. It was a law for the children to be treated fairly, that each child had the right to speak and to be heard. It told you what you could and couldn't do when you went into the house, that you could not raise your voice and be the boss, any kind of aggressive, that we were here to get along and to be a part of a community. And those children were the community, and they knew that, and they treated that with so much respect. I don't believe I had ever been, I can't speak for Tina, but I've never been on a trip where the Christian word meant so much. And to watch those children who I knew had been through horrific things completely devote themselves to learning about God and following the Christian path was just amazing. It was, we visited one home where the children sang to us. And they sang a song about God. And a lot of times you didn't know the words, but you could get the rhythm of the song. And you may even know that that song, you remember that from here. But I don't believe any of us left with a dry eye. It was such a peaceful and accepting place to be. And you look out through these children, you might have 30 children sitting in front of you, working together, holding hands, listening to the older ones when they would say what songs they were going to sing. They would play the guitar. Those children had such respect for where they were. And it was very powerful to watch while we were there. And that was just the first 3 days in Kathmandu. Kathmandu was where we went to acclimate to the climate, to kind of recover from the trip there. One of our flights was 16 hours in the air, so it was a long flight. It was a long trip. And so they gave us that time just to be still. And they, in fact, they encouraged us to be quiet and just listen to what our heart was saying as well. So,
before we leave the first 3 days, the question that keeps going through my head as I'm also listening is, these children have been through hell and back.
Truly.
Incredible trauma in their lives. And yet you're describing children that seem to be adjusting and moving forward in life. And I'm not sure I see that with traumatized children in the United States. What's the difference?
We had so many conversations about that.
Okay.
That there's no bureaucracy to get in the way. It's just people trying to care about other people, and kids with very similar experiences understanding each other and what they need from each other was just somebody who cares about them. And the school is the same way. In the environment, it's so obvious that the children will be treated with respect and that they will, the children will be cared for. It is a nurturing and safe place to be. And they do it to each other. They don't even have to leave to go out into Kathmandu if they don't choose to. All the support they need is right there. And that's the biggest thing we noticed. It's like, would this even work in the United States? Because there's too much of a bureaucratic system. And foster children, for instance, they're not all together where they can support each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're separated out. Sure. And not that foster families aren't going to love and care about them. But then they're kind of the outsider in the home. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't have where they feel like people understand them, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or whereas there's no question. Mm-hmm. The principal, the teachers, their previous children that have stayed there to help.
Okay.
So there's an, everybody understands the situation. Like Angie was saying, they can fly away. That's part of it. Everybody's so happy when they choose to go out into the world, or they can choose to stay and have jobs there. And a lot of them do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them do. Because they want to, honestly, it's because they want to give back, and they'll say that.
Talked about in the homes the fact that we would never be able to go to a home and visit the way we were able to go there. And then to see children, 8 to 10 children per bedroom, you don't see that in the United States.
Right.
It's not allowed. Even a home, a foster home, is not allowed typically to have 8 or 10 children that are not their own.
And they were separated like by gender.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be, I think there were 2 houses for young
boys,
and then I think the rest were for young girls.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they were intermingling in the home or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all just girls that were in 8 beds a room. But they cared about each other.
And I think there was an expectation of how you act and what you do. I don't think that in the United States we make it mandatory for, or not socially acceptable to not behave. You know, we have a thought that says you can misbehave, you have consequences, but that's part of letting kids grow. Well, they don't do that there. You don't misbehave, and that's just the exception. I mean, that's the expectation. And I never saw any of those children misbehave.
And no one yells, though.
No one yells.
It was always with just compassion that this is why we don't do these things this way.
Is any of that from the Nepalese culture, or is it all because of the culture that Silvio has put together in the homes and the schools?
I think it's both. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I think Silvio's worked really hard, including and the leadership that they have in the school. It's the right people in the right place at the right time. Very carefully chosen people that are willing to have Christian attitude. And again, they're taught English and Christianity in a Hindu country.
Mm-hmm.
So it is people that are supportive of that too.
Mm-hmm.
We had one time where we were at the school watching the kids line up. So they have a courtyard where it's covered and it's a basketball. It's kind of like a basketball court. But the kids would eat every morning, would line up in rows.
And by age.
So you kind of see it go up. But at every head of every row was an older student.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an expectation that that row stayed straight and you stayed quiet and you paid attention and you did the things you were supposed to do. One time I saw one of the older boys, I believe, went down the row and he just told one of the kids, move over, straighten the line up. And the little one just did it and went right back to standing like he was supposed to. But I never saw anyone like enforce that.
Right.
It was the expectation that you just do that.
I think a lot of it is too the rules on the outside of the house is how everything is. We will treat these children with respect. They will treat each other with respect. That's the expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, you can see it.
They were ornery. There was a few. I mean, they would do ornery things with us. They would, you know.
Not the boys.
Well, no. They would
but
play.
They giggle, too.
They would giggle.
It's like they, you know, they were being playful.
Yeah. But they didn't get out of line. They didn't take it too far.
Yeah.
But I didn't see anyone be corrected in any way that we would see a stern kind of angry.
They were grateful to be there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's part of it, too.
Yeah.
A lot of respect.
That was as close to heaven as you can get, considering mm-hmm. their options.
Right.
Even back in the family home, when you love your family, but you don't know where the next meal's coming for the family, and meals are, you know, you have three healthy meals here. So
then on day four or so, we headed up the mountain to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 60-mile drive that took 10 hours.
Wow.
And it was rough.
And that wasn't because of stops. That's how long it took to drive there. I think we stopped once to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. And the smog was just horrific. It was so hard to breathe. A lot of people wore masks, but I know I covered my...
From vehicles or factories cooking stoves, all of the above.
Mm-hmm. All of the above, but the majority of traffic are motorcycles.
Right.
And everybody commutes three people on a motorcycle, and it is raw diesel. Mm-hmm. Everything smells like raw diesel.
Yes, sure.
And it just
burns.
It'll make your eyes water.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were all, I just couldn't hardly breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was checking what is going on, because I've never been to a place like that before.
Right.
With that kind of smog.
Sure.
And to give you an idea, our air quality here in Howard County is 34.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a green. If you look up on your weather app, the air quality in Kathmandu, it was 183,
mm-hmm.
bright red, way beyond tapping off of the, you know, air quality scale. And
so as you climb up
your
the mountain, you see the smog, you feel yourself going through the smog. So that trip was really tough to breathe through. Your eyes water. You can't take a good breath. You're on a bus, you know.
It made me think differently about emissions.
Yes. It really did. It did. And the roads are very narrow. And you drive on the opposite side of the road. So everything feels different. And it's a constant, like, alert. I think our bodies were on high alert the whole time. You're having trouble breathing. The altitude is different. The climate is different. Everything feels off. And so you...
And was it a private bus with just you all? Or was it full of Nepalese and
it was a private
chickens?
Bus.
And, okay.
But we had other... the people who were in Kathmandu at the school, several of them then went with us. So we had
at the farm.
To work at the farm. They were so excited. I think the people who live at the farm were so excited to
come
see.
Back down.
Yeah. And so it's you know, when your friends live up on the mountain and you get the opportunity to go to the farm and work for a week, you're excited.
Sure.
We had a little boy with us on the bus that was going with his mother up. And so he was with us. And I think there were probably... 4 or 5 other people with us other than our crew. So the medical team had left already, and we stayed home in Kathmandu for one more day. The medical team left, and then they were going to meet us at the farm shortly after we got there. So Tina and I were with the construction crew when we loaded onto the vans to head up the mountain. And that was an all day trip. We did stop a couple of times to go to the bathroom, which that was an experience because it's not your typical flushable bathrooms.
Right.
If anybody listening has ever done a squatty potty, then they'll relate. If you've not,
you
it's
should.
Just an experience.
Oh, yeah. It's all over the Orient.
Yes. So, and we ate, we stopped to eat one place and then we arrived at the farm. The roads became very narrow and very rough, so you never went very fast. You know, maybe 20, 30 miles an hour at the most. But about a mile before we got to the farm, we had to get out and walk. So they were going to get the buses there, which I'm not even really sure. They left several of them at that spot, but then they took a Jeep and took our luggage on, and then most of us walked the rest of the way.
Just too rugged of a road. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we arrived at the farm, which is on the side of the mountain. Literally on the side of the mountain. So when you woke up, you looked down or out. There wasn't any looking side by side. It was everything was straight down or up the mountain to eat, or you were looking out over the mountains.
Now, you inferred that there was an income from the farm that helped pay for all these homes and schools. How do they make any income off that farm?
Well, what it was is just the farming resources themselves became the food.
I gotcha. Mm-hmm.
So they had, for instance, and that's part of what had been damaged by the earthquake, and so it was part of what their a rebuilding effort. Mm-hmm. So they had a very large chicken coop, not quite like ours around here, but it was very large. I think Silvio said they had about 300 chickens there that they had butchered prior to our arrival. So there weren't chickens there when we were there, but they had been sent down to the schools and the homes. Yeah. The eggs and everything like that. Plus they had greenhouses for vegetables and things like that. They had goats. They had, what else did they have?
So we were there to help build a hog unit. So it was a farrowing shed. And so I don't remember how many hogs it would have held, but
probably about 20.
Maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the biggest job that we were there for was to paint
this.
Yeah. And to get water down. So the nipple feeder waterers, one of the guys with us had been there before. And so he had gone home and drawn up, kind of engineered how the water would get to the hog shed.
Kind of a natural flow process. Yeah.
Because
there's no rural water.
Yeah, there's no, so it's all caught and then funneled
down. Did they
have
to worry about freezing there? Mm-hmm. Or was it always about freezing?
They had to take some care with that, yeah.
But we didn't have heat in our...
Right.
In any of the, there was no heat in the bathrooms, no heat in our buildings where we slept.
And it probably got down in the, I'd say one night, maybe even the 20s.
Yeah, it got very cold.
Yeah, no heat.
Yeah, and then February was about as cold as you're going to get there too.
Yeah, it was very cold. Yeah. And I think that really kind of throws you off physically, emotionally.
Right.
It was kind of a rough trip just because of the cold.
And then we were, some folks were helping then to assist to reconstruct, like the place we stayed in was one big open room with probably, I don't know, 16
bunk beds.
Eight bunks. And they needed to build another one. And so they were working on that. And again, it's on the side of, you know, the mountain. So those were kind of the construction projects going on. But from the farm where we were, we could look down and there was a village down there. And so after a couple of days of trying to kind of help paint and do things like that, we walked down the hill to the village down below, and that's where the medical team was and a dental van that they have and a dentist. And the dental van that they have, it's amazing. It's a fully operational dentist office in a van. And so the school down there was kind of the town center. And so when we walked down there to just kind of help triage, you know, help line people up, find out whose, you know, teeth were in the worst pain and kind of make an order to the process or who needed medical assistance. Again, there are no clinics there. There's no way to get medical care. If you don't have a home remedy, that's your only really shot there. So all ages, children to the elderly, we're all congregating into the area. So we were kind of assisting to, okay, is this a dental person that, you know, a dental need? Is this some kind of other health concern? And we just spent the day there trying to help the team organize that while the doctors and nurses kind of did their what they do. But right there at the school, it was interesting. As I said, I'd been a teacher for a decade, actually in Howard County that whole time. And I know the resources that it takes in the classroom and things like that. And I'd asked the kids, a couple of the kids that were just being so friendly and wanting to show us around, could I see their classroom? So we went in, and there's nothing. Mm-hmm. There's benches.
Yeah.
That's about it.
There's no windows.
No, yeah.
No doors. So there's no way to lock it up or...
Blackboard?
There is a small blackboard.
Okay.
That's the only thing really on the wall for the most part. A couple of kids did have a notebook in there with their stuff. But you open it and they've written on every single tiny white, place so that notebook lasts as long as possible. Mm-hmm. So that was a little heartbreaking.
And their backpacks were just tattered. Mm-hmm. So it looked like backpacks had been passed down and tied together, sewn together for these kiddos. But almost every child had a uniform on because that was something that was very... their uniform would be tattered as well. It looked like it had been passed down, but they were very proud of the way that they looked when they came.
Well, and I think it's important to, as far as our standards, doesn't mean that's the standard everywhere. And all of those kids seemed extremely happy. I mean, that was what their whole community was like. You know, it's like my granny used to say during the Depression, she said, we didn't know we were poor. Everybody was poor. We were totally happy, We just didn't have much. So all those kids were happy. We did
see a little more children picking on children at that village than we had at the previous school where we had been.
Right.
So you saw a little bit more of that, what we would consider normal behavior. On the playground, some of the kids were picking on another child or something like that. But I never saw anyone get onto them, now that I think about that. I didn't see. The kids kind of just took care of it.
And this was a government school kind of run by the community. This wasn't attached to you all.
No, this was not attached to what we were doing.
This was a Nepalese school.
Yeah, in a village. And so when the... when the medical team and the dental team showed up, people from the mountain came down to this village and came to the clinic. Mm-hmm. It just happened to be at the school. Because there really, other than the school, there were just a few houses around.
How frequently would a medical team come into this village?
Once every couple of years.
Yeah.
Oof, wow.
Well, and just to kind of explain a little bit why, as we go back to the idea of having a Christian organization in a Hindu country, Apple of God's Eye had the school, the residential homes, and the farm. And everyone around the farm is Hindu. And again, the last thing you want to do is make waves or you want to be a positive. Sylvia wanted to be a positive light to the community. And so this was part of giving back to the community for just respecting their presence of being there and not making it difficult. They were very grateful because when they do come, they benefit from that as well. And we're very happy. And I might say that there wasn't anesthesia for the dental, in the dental clinic. So they got teeth pulled and everything out knowing that. I mean, they knew that full well before they even went in, and they were just as happy as could be.
Yeah. And you never heard anyone scream, cry.
We all know how bad a tooth, toothaches are terrible. And so they could finally get that taken care of. But I will say, no matter where we went, most of the medical concerns are chest and stomach related. And it's just the air quality.
And they did, I did hear them say to two elderly people that they needed to go to the hospital, and they would just take that news and whether or not they went, I don't know, but they did tell them you need to go to the hospital. But we had brought with us on this team, antibiotics, a lot of Tums or some type of antacid, medication. Antibiotics. Oh, ointment, like for skin conditions. So different.
There's something that they get there, and again, I don't. There's I don't know the medical term for it, but there's a rash that just consistently doesn't go away.
It's almost like a fungus or something on the skin, and so there was an ointment for that they gave to a lot of people. Yeah. A lot of antibiotics, though.
Probably people in that village did not go down into Kathmandu to work.
Probably never.
No.
Yeah.
Had no means of even
getting there. So they were just subsistence farming, a few little shops.
And and no vehicles really to speak of.
Now, was there pollution problems there in that valley too?
Well, I didn't feel like there was, but I think they just
could see it.
You know,
I see. You could kind of see it rising. Okay. It hid the mountains a lot.
Yeah.
That and the clouds. We were getting up high enough that it was a mixture of both.
I remember the site when I was in the Navy flying into L.A.
Mm-hmm.
back in the early 70s. It was brown. The air was brown.
And they're cooking indoors over constant heat, wood heat. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, that the wood smoke is in the house all the time. It never goes away.
Yeah.
And so they're just in that kind of smoky air all the time. And the air quality is just not good.
What is some of the... Did you get a sense of what their basic diet was there? Was it rice or flour or...
And we had an opportunity. We had some folks that were cooking our food for us, and they did a fantastic job.
They did. Fantastic.
Beans for protein a lot of the times, but we also got meat. That's probably not customary.
We had a lot of chicken, but they also fed us beef a few times, which we were surprised.
Yes.
We did not think we would get beef at all. And
cows are, you know, a sacred animal to the Hindu. And you can definitely tell that in Kathmandu. There's cows everywhere. Cows and monkeys are very respected, and they're everywhere. Sam.
Everywhere.
When I say everywhere, I mean everywhere.
Amazing.
You know, along with there's not a sanitation system.
Right. And probably not enough milk in the animals even for people to bother to milk the cows.
And I don't think they're allowed to do that.
See any milk products that would have been coming from cows.
Now, I know the Nepalese cuisine is very Indian in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So lentils and rice. And so I think they're, you know, getting plenty of protein. But we got fruit. But I think probably to say a lot of people living there probably don't have a lot of fruit in their diet.
We also got a lot of vegetables. We had a lot of broccoli, a lot of cauliflower, carrots. That was probably it. Broccoli, cauliflower, and carrots. And then beans, rice, and maybe a little bit of meat. I missed bread. I noticed that we didn't have bread very often.
So wheat was not a...
And they have a different kind of bread. I mean, their bread is you know, like
flat breads, pan bread.
Yeah.
Did you need interpreters at all?
Because all the
kids spoke English, too.
Most places they would speak English, but we did have interpreters when we went to the pharmacy in Kathmandu. They sent us with someone that could speak. I also had a feeling that they wanted to make sure that we weren't taken advantage of when we tried to pay for it.
Sure.
So they sent us with an interpreter there, and then Silvio's son had grown up there. His name was David, wasn't it? And David was with us almost the entire time. He was a very young man. I would say
early
20s. Lots of fun. Just a really good-hearted
kid. He'd spent some
time
in the United States. So, you know, he could tell some jokes about his experience here.
He was well-traveled. You could tell. He knew his way around. And so he kind of took care of us. And so he went with us everywhere we went. And he would speak for us. So that was kind of our interpreter.
Right.
But most people we met, not in the village up at the farm, but most people in Kathmandu could speak English to
that
some
we
extent.
Were around.
That we
that
were
we
around.
Were around. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did Silvio and his family speak Portuguese in their home?
I believe so.
They spoke actually quite a few languages.
Yes.
He was a very, very sharp guy.
He and his wife and his children all could speak several. They had lived in a lot of different areas, so they could speak
again,
a lot of
language. He'd been a missionary for about 20 years, so 8 in Nepal, he's been around.
He's been around.
He spent some time in Italy. They all spoke Italian, so.
I spent time in Brazil, and I don't know if I ever met a Brazilian that wasn't just a joy to be around.
He was.
He was a joy.
He really was.
Yeah. Very kind man. Yeah. Very kind, but knew what he wanted to get done.
Sure.
What to get accomplished and how to do it.
Right.
And his team really respected him. They waited for him to give the directions.
Right. The team was accomplishing a bunch of things. Y'all fell right into what you needed to do and got some things done then, which was
especially at the
hog facility.
Especially, yeah. But we went there telling them, we'll do whatever you need us to do. They knew we were social workers by, you know, trade, and everybody kind of came with their own set of skills, and everybody could do what, the, you know, could help and contribute to
And I think that's something Tina and I've learned over the times that we've done different mission trips, is you have to go with a very open mind that it's going to be different. The food will be different. You may be hungry at times because you can't digest what they're giving or something. The beds will be different. You take it and you learn from it, and that helps us grow. I know every trip we've ever been on, Tina and I have come home and said, what did we learn? You know, what was our role there? And it's never been about cleaning out the houses in New Orleans or painting in Nepal. It's always been something that we've learned about who we are, what we have, or how we feel about our lives, what we want to give back to others.
And just a connection with other people. And just letting them know somebody cares. I always say, I have brothers and sisters all over the world. I just don't have brothers and sisters in one place. And that's how I still feel. And when I leave there, that's how I feel, you know?
It's hard to go back to being a tourist after you do a mission trip. It's very hard to go back because you know behind the scenes, there's so much more to learn. So
off that beaten path.
Yeah. So Tina and I try to plan one as consistently as we can, as life will allow us. Of course, that COVID kind of threw us really for a wrench. We weren't allowed to do a lot. But I think we have plans to do another one.
And honestly, too, while we just have a chance before I forget, for anybody who may be listening, the kids at the school and the teachers and the administration work together to create a movie. And if you go to 12,000.com.
Spell it out. 12,000.com.
All lowercase. 12,000.com is the movie that they created to try to help people understand the situation of child trafficking in Nepal. And the reason it's called 12,000 is that's how many children per year from Nepal are trafficked. And Nepal is about the size of probably one of our, you know, Midwest states. And we looked that up, and there's about 240 people trafficked in Missouri a year. And there are 12,000 in Nepal. And so it just kind of, and it was difficult for some of the children to make the story, but they felt it was important. So that's where people can find it if they would like to.
It's about 30-minute video that really, and the children in the homes made the movie. So they are the actors in the movie, and it's very powerful, very powerful.
The other site that's pretty powerful is to go to appleofgodseye.org. And there's a video there of the children and their home and the school. And the children that are in that video are the same children we met there.
Every time I watch it, I smile because we remember being there and seeing those children. So it's very powerful.
Yeah.
Does Nepal have a king, or it's not a democracy, surely?
They had, I believe, a prime minister.
Okay.
But it's not a very well-functioning government. I think it's pretty corrupt. And Silvio will say it's pretty corrupt. It's hard to get really anything done just because of the level of corruption there. So it takes knowing who you know and what you can, you know, offer in exchange to get something done. You know what I mean?
And I think Silvio has a really good reputation now, so he's able to get more done. But his wife talked about when they first went there, how difficult it was to get the government to help them at all or even allow them to do what they were doing. They had to spend a lot of time building that relationship. And Silvio still keeps them at arm's length because he knows it can turn in a minute. But right now, they're letting him grow with this program. We were told not to bring our Bibles with us and not to wear, the women should keep their upper arms covered. So not to show anything. We could wear t-shirts, but they had to be fairly long-sleeved. And Silvio wants us to be safe and wanted to show the government that we are respecting their wishes as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's always interesting to me. I don't know, you probably both know John Nordemeyer, who works, he works in Djibouti with aid groups that are aiding the Somalis. Mm-hmm. And it is a Muslim country, mm-hmm. and no one can do Christian missionary mm-hmm. work there. But as the same as Silvio, he has developed such a understanding with the government that I am here mm-hmm. to help people, that as long as he doesn't become anything on print mm-hmm. about being a Christian, he can say whatever he wants mm-hmm. and call himself a Christian, but do not put it in print. Mm-hmm. And that's probably about the same as in Nepal.
Yeah, it is.
Very similar.
Yeah. Something about putting it in print.
When we had to get a visa when we got to Nepal, mm-hmm. and we had to apply for it, and they even told us to be very careful about what we put that we were doing mm-hmm. while we were there. So to get through customs, they wanted to make sure that we were safe and could get through customs easily.
We were volunteering and just left it at that.
Yeah, there was no, there was some other things we could have marked, but they just said, just mark that.
It wasn't for religious purposes. No. It was just for volunteering.
And they probably knew it was for what you were up to. But it's like when I had the raw milk business. Mm-hmm. The state knew about it. They knew it was legal. Mm-hmm. We knew better than to advertise.
Right.
Do not put it in print, because mm-hmm. that just, the world explodes. The officials explode if it's in print.
Yeah.
Well, when we talk about those 450 kids, but that's how many are there now. There's kids coming in and kids, you know, that are able to return home mm-hmm. and different things all the time.
Sure.
So it's not the same 450 kids. He has really touched and helped a tremendous number of children over the last 8 years.
A lot.
And so,
and they rehabilitate. They work to rehabilitate the family system.
Hmm.
So a lot of these kids can go back home, and that's their wish, is that they go back home.
Hmm.
But there's a lot of work that goes into making sure that those homes are safe for those kids to return to.
And that the same problem just won't happen again.
Right, right.
I had to dig out a 1980 encyclopedia, and it said there were 18 million people in Nepal. Yeah. And I was shocked at that.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And it probably is still a larger number now, but
and
that's
you can
still a lot
sure tell when you're there.
Yeah, Kathmandu is extremely congested.
Yes.
And I know there's a lot of people that come there to hike Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. You can definitely tell when you get there. There's a lot of attention paid to, there's shops everywhere on, what you need, gear that you need mm-hmm. and things like that.
Yeah.
So
have you all started thinking about your next trip yet? Doing any research? Or are you still recovering from this one?
It's going to be a while to recover from this. And Angie kind of skipped one part about she did get altitude sickness. I'm saying this because I felt bad for her.
Sure.
The first day at the farm for about 24 hours.
It was rough.
I took a picture of her because she's just laying in the sun. She was so cold and just
miserable.
Felt even more cold because she was sick.
That's the only illness you all had, though?
Only
I
illness.
I had kind of just cold and, a cold.
Well,
I thought maybe
were
the flu
very
would
lucky,
be cold.
Really.
Yeah, yeah. So, actually, we have a trip coming up, but it's for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were just talking about, so how do we go about this next? Hope Force International, they also have teams that go to Haiti. And they're still continuing to try to assist there.
Really?
They also have places in the United States. And McDowell County is one that I feel like I would enjoy.
Yeah.
Part of that is just because it's such an isolated, it's just so very isolated that just having people from outside coming in to help fix a step. To just let them know, we care about what's happening, what can we do to help.
Probably a very big drug presence in that county.
Yeah.
So that's where the opioid epidemic seems to have their center there. So, but I think that we're leaning towards going to that area probably in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Like she said, we're 2024, we're going to go be tourists. In February, but then after that, hopefully we can 2025, we can do this trip to McDowell County.
Huh.
Huh. And yeah. You never know. You know, every time we've given several presentations and we always say, and it's true, if anybody mm-hmm. is ever interested in doing this, just to contact us, because we've even put teams together ourselves and, mm-hmm. and led those to different projects. Yakima Indian Reservation, we've done that one mm-hmm. as well.
We were actually able to take our daughters on that one, so mm-hmm. that was really a fun and interesting mm-hmm. trip. My mother's gone on several trips mm-hmm. with either myself or with Tina. So I think that there's a wide variety of things that we need to do. So you don't feel like you have to be construction savvy. Right. You don't
There's
have to be a
something.
Medical team. You don't have to be social workers like we are. You can really find a purpose on every trip if you want to go.
Yeah.
Is there anything that came from that experience in Nepal that you see creeped a little bit into your occupations now?
I was very interested in listening to how they treat trauma. As a therapist, it was very interesting to me what modalities they used and how they treated that, how they trained their clinicians. So we have master's degree.
Sure.
They just have training,
yeah.
Which is interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But the approach is much different than it is here. And I think that makes all the difference in the world. Kind of like how they treat their homes. Homes are much different here. It's treated much different. So I think that it comes up often how privileged we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I got home from one of our trips, in fact, it was a trip to Costa Rica. I came home and I started thinking that we had too much stuff.
Yeah.
We have so much stuff.
Right.
And so I started cleaning and throwing out and, getting rid of. And my husband said, you know, what's happening? Are you leaving? What's going on? And I said, no, I just feel so cluttered. You know, that wears off after you've been home for a year. You're all of a sudden you're starting to collect it again. But I think every trip we come home changed on the inside. And it affects everything we do. Affects the way we treat our children, our grandchildren, how we see the world, how we see our government, how we see the things that we do here.
Right.
So I don't know that we always have a way to talk about it. Tina and I talked about the first presentation we gave about Nepal. What do we say?
Yeah.
How we're still processing at that point. Yeah.
How do we say what we experienced?
Mm-hmm.
It's an ongoing thing.
For me, it's just always a humbling experience and just learning that I'm no better than anybody else. It, you know, sometimes I think, and we live in a great country, but I think sometimes priorities get misplaced in our rat race every day. When you strip away all the unnecessary things, you know, poverty is a desperate thing for a lot of people. But at the same time, some of the happiest people, and I don't want to misrepresent or mischaracterize the Nepalese people, because they're all, I don't care where you are, they're laughing, mm-hmm. they're having fun with each other.
Singing.
They may not have shoes, but they're, mm-hmm. and even when we were in that village where, you know, the community was coming together, they were helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
Some didn't have shoes. Some were sharing mm-hmm. things with each other that somebody had, and I just think that sometimes when you strip away all the stuff and all the, you know, extra in your life and you get down to the basics, again, I'm no better than anybody else in what we want in life and just to be happy and, our, you know, to take care of our families and...
Getting sick and not having home was tough that 24 hours. Tough emotionally, tough physically, but lying outside on that concrete pad, trying to catch as much sun as I could, you lay there and you think about what life is like and what is it that we highly respect and need. There's tough moments as you go through that, but every moment brings you a little bit closer to who you are.
Or who you're supposed to be.
Well, thanks, gang. I really didn't have to ask many questions, did I?
We can kind of get on the roll.
we're both talkers, so sometimes that's a bad thing.
Great. Well, I hope this gets a lot of listening, and you've given folks some nice places where they can view what you all experienced.
Thank you.
Thank you. You bet.